Welcome back to the second half of our episode. And if you ran out and got some popcorn, I hope you sprinkled some capers on it, since that's what we're digesting today, right?
Yes. Ha ha ha. I did say at the beginning of the episode that we were both of these movies were heist movies. So now let's get right into it, as Claude will give us the plot description for the remake of Ocean's 11.
Yes, indeed. Just as we did in Thomas Crown Affair, we are hearing dialogue over the production company logos. It's the sounds of a prison this time, and we hear that a prisoner is being transported from one place to another. And as the story itself opens, we see Danny Ocean, portrayed by George Clooney. He's a convicted thief, and he's being questioned by the parole board about his impending release from prison and the chances of his breaking the law again. The board implies that they know he's been involved in several other robberies and con games and fraud cases, although he was never officially accused or charged. And Danny simply says, yep, that's right, never charged. When asked why he committed this particular crime or why he was caught this time, Danny says the reason for his crime was that his ex-wife left him and he spiraled out of control. The board then asks him what he would do if he was released from prison, and he just stares at them, but he doesn't answer the question, at least not before the edit. So Ocean is released from his New Jersey prison, and he goes to an Atlantic City casino to meet with an old friend, Frank Cotton, played by Bernie Mac. Frank works there as a blackjack dealer under a different name, and the two of them pretend not to know each other and use code phrases so that they can meet up somewhere else, a little bit, you know, more private and away from security. They talk about him and where to find him, and Frank asks Danny if he already has a job in mind, to which Danny states, hey, I just got out of prison. Next, Danny's off to Hollywood to meet with him, and him turns out to be his frequent accomplice, Rusty Ryan, who's played by Brad Pitt. Rusty has been spending his time teaching young actors how to play real poker. Danny sneaks into their game, and with a little help from Rusty, he cons the stars, all of whom are playing themselves, uncredited by the way, into betting a lot of money on a hand that Danny wins easily. From there, they go to another club where Danny reveals he has a job in mind targeting casino owner Terry Benedict, who is played by Andy Garcia. Benedict owns three Las Vegas casino hotels, the Bellagio, the Mirage, and the MGM Grand. All three casinos share one vault, and Ocean plans to assemble a crew to empty that vault. Rusty is kind of skeptical of Danny's plan, but he does offer up his support, and together they go over exactly what would be needed to pull the job and who they could get to finance the operation. They find their financier in their old friend, a ridiculously wealthy guy named Ruben Tishkoff. He's played by Elliot Gould, who just recently lost his own casino hotel to Terry Benedict. Ruben is not interested at first because he knows a lot about the outrageously tight security in casinos, having invented a lot of it himself, and he says the scheme is not likely to succeed. But when he learns that Benedict is the target of the heist, oh, that's a horse of a different color, and Ruben is in. Now they have financial backing, so they start assembling the crew. Frank Cotton pulls a scam to get transferred to one of Benedict's casinos in Las Vegas to serve as an inside man. The Malloy brothers, Turk and Virgil, they're played by Scott Kahn and Casey Affleck. They're a pair of car enthusiasts from Utah, and they're brought in for transportation and a few other skills. In charge of electronics is Livingston Dell. He's played by Eddie Jemison. Basher Tarr, who's played by an uncredited Don Cheadle, is at the top of the list for explosives. But unfortunately, he's being arrested for another job, so Rusty has to rescue him by playing an arrogant ATF officer. In San Diego, they find their grease man in Yen. He's played by Xiaobo Qin. He's a circus acrobat, and Rusty then meets up and convinces old-timer Saul Bloom out of retirement in Florida. And Saul is played by Carl Reiner. So with 10 people already committed, Danny and Rusty figure they need one more member. Otherwise, I have to change the title of the movie, I guess. So Danny has to go to Chicago to recruit a young but very skilled pickpocket named Linus Caldwell. That's played by Matt Damon. He's the son of the thief Bobby Caldwell, who referred him to Danny without telling him it's his son. At the team's first meeting at Ruben's house, Danny gives fair warning to everyone that this job could be extremely lucrative, but it's also extremely dangerous. And if they join him inside the house, they're now officially part of the job and they cannot back out. Everyone goes in except Linus, who still appears reluctant until Reuben intervenes. Danny and Rusty proceed to reveal the target and all the security measures they're going to have to deal with in order to pull off the job. Now, a typical casino has an impressive amount of money during the week and an even bigger number on the weekend, but there is a major boxing match coming up in 2 weeks, and on that night, the take is going to be in the neighborhood of $150 million. The team sets up camp and prepares to carry out the caper. They canvass the whole location to make sure they know everything there is to know. They tap into the surveillance system to keep an eye on everything and everyone. They build an exact replica of the vault in a warehouse to familiarize themselves and practice parts of their plan, mostly for Yen to learn how to move around inside the vault without triggering the alarm system, because that's going to be fully functional during his part of the heist. Saul impersonates an international arms dealer who is staying at the hotel and looking to ask Benedict for a favor. Under the pretense of wanting to stash some extremely valuable stones safely, Saul cons Benedict into offering to stash them into his casino vault, but the stones in question are explosives created by Basher to look like valuable gems. Linus is assigned to shadowing Terry Benedict. He's excited to be included in the group, but he's upset that with all his skills, he's not getting a lot of responsibility. During his surveillance of Benedict, Linus unknowingly reveals to Rusty something that Danny had been keeping secret from everybody else so far, his true motive for pulling the job. Terry Benedict's girlfriend is Danny's ex-wife, Tess. She's played by Julia Roberts. Rusty confronts Danny at the warehouse, where Danny admits that he knows about Terry and Tess dating, and that his intention is to win her back. Rusty threatens to abandon the project altogether, thinking Danny might compromise the job to get his wife back. Danny assures him he has a very specific plan for Tess, and the rest of the crew is not in jeopardy of losing their fair share of the score. Danny surprises Tess at a restaurant and admits to her that he came to Vegas to take her back, and that just makes her angry. But despite that hostility, we're still seeing some compassion and, dare I say it, a little romance subtext. We also learn that Tess and Terry's relationship isn't necessarily what she'd like it to be. Terry shows up to join Tess for dinner, and he's not especially concerned by Danny's intentions toward either his money or his girlfriend. When Reuben's former hotel is professionally imploded, Basher brings the team some bad news. A weakness he was looking to exploit in the hotel's electrical system will no longer be available due to the city's electrical engineer now being aware of that weakness, and they are fixing it. As a solution, he offers to use something called an electrical pinch. It's a device that fries circuitry by sending in a huge electromagnetic pulse. Plugging the device into one of the main city power lines would allow them to turn off all the power in Las Vegas for about 30 seconds, which is what they need. However, the device is in California, and that means the team has to make a side trip. So, Danny, Basher, Yen, Linus, and the Malloys all take a van, and they drive to California. Linus is left in the van with the brothers, which annoys him quickly because of their bickering, and finally he gives up and he goes inside to join Danny, but at the same time, Danny and the others have already grabbed the device and they are exiting the building through a different door. They leave only to realize that Linus is no longer with them. Linus is able to escape the building, but not without getting chased by security, and because of all the hurry-up action, Yen's hand is badly injured when it gets slammed in the van's door. The team learns that Danny has been red flagged by the hotel, and so they'll be looking for him constantly. Linus is still embarrassed by his mistake, so he reveals that Danny is after Tess, and that's the reason he was flagged, and Rusty has to confess to Danny that he ordered Linus to watch him. Now that Danny isn't able to take a step in the hotel without being tracked, he's considered a liability, and Rusty kicks him off the team. The responsibility of triggering the vault is given to Linus. It's the kind of thing he's been looking for, but it also has him very nervous. Fight night arrives and everything is set in motion. Yen is hidden inside one of the vault carts and he sneaked into the vault along with Saul's suitcase containing the explosive fake gems. To get close to the vault and to keep Terry distracted, Linus poses an agent of the Gaming Commission who comes to Terry with evidence that the Bellagio is illegally employing a convicted criminal as a dealer. The criminal in question is Frank, who drags out the interrogation on purpose by accusing Linus of being a racist. During the altercation with Frank, Linus pickpockets the vault security codes from Benedict. Terry is so eager to get back to his scheduled evening after this meeting that when, on the way out, Linus claims to have left his beeper behind in the conference room, Terry leaves Linus to show himself out. Instead of leaving, of course, Linus used the codes to make his way to the vault elevator. Meanwhile, Danny meets up with Tess, claiming he will leave her alone and giving her one last kiss on the cheek before leaving. As he does so, he also slips a cell phone into her pocket, but we don't see that until a flashback later on. He then hangs out at the hotel's casino, where he makes a point of letting Benedict see him. Benedict orders a pair of thugs to teach Danny a lesson. The thugs lead Danny to a private back room, and they leave him alone with a huge biker-looking guy to beat him up. But the man happens to be a friend of Danny's who is paid a lot of money to pretend he is beating up Danny. So the man throws stuff around and he hollers a lot, so it sounds like Danny's getting badly beaten. Meanwhile, Danny is actually going into the hotel's air duct and making his way to the vault's elevator shaft, where he surprises Linus, revealing he and Rusty played Linus to give him this opportunity. In the meantime, Rusty, Saul, Turk, and Virgil distract the vault monitors in the security headquarters by having Saul pretend to have a heart attack. While the monitors are distracted, Livingston taps into the computer system and has it display a video that they shot in their vault's replica, where all they see from then on is a peaceful vault with nothing going on inside. He also makes Linus disappear from the other cameras when he's heading to the vault. So, with everyone in position, Basher triggers the pinch, cuts power to the entire city. Danny and Linus break into the vault with some help from Yen waiting inside, all of it unseen by the video cameras. Rusty then calls Terry on the cell phone that Danny slipped to test to reveal that he is being robbed. Terry goes to a security center, looks at the monitors, says nothing's happening, until the monitors switch back to the real live feed and show three men in the vault packing all of the money into black duffel bags marked with big white X's. The robbers rig the money with explosives and they split it into two parts. They threaten to blow up all the money unless Benedict lets them get away with half of it. Upon hearing this, Benedict calls 911 and asks for a SWAT team. Benedict complies with Rusty's demands, knowing that the SWAT team is on the way. With half the money in the vault and half the money being driven away in a van, Benedict accepts the loss and focuses on catching the culprits by allowing the SWAT team to enter the vault under cover of darkness. SWAT enters the vault in the dark, and we hear a confrontation during which the explosives have triggered, blowing up the money. Benedict goes down to the vault to assess the damages, and he tells SWAT to leave the premises. Benedict then orders his men to retrieve the money from the van, but learns that the van was blown up too. Then he and we learn that the van was not carrying money, but just flyers advertising prostitutes. Benedict realizes he's been played, and now we get the reveal that the video feed of the men inside the vault was also a video shot inside the team vault replica. Livingston had tapped into the hotel's phone network, intercepted the 911 call, and the SWAT team that responded was the rest of Ocean's crew coming down to help clear out the vault. In the dark, the crew staged a confrontation when they were actually loading the real money into their gear bags. Benedict realizes that somebody made a duplicate of his vault and that he just watched the SWAT team walk out with all of his money. Meanwhile, Tess is up in her room, now fully aware that Danny is robbing her boyfriend, when she receives a phone call to turn the TV to a specific channel. The channel in question is the camera feed outside the back room where Danny is supposedly getting beat up. By this point, Danny has slipped back into the room and allowed the big guy to give him a few real shots for looks. Terry goes in to confront Danny, assuming that he is somehow responsible. While never admitting anything, Danny asks Terry if he'd be willing to give up Tess in exchange for his money back, knowing full well that Tess is now listening. Terry agrees immediately, and Tess decides she's out. Danny then says he knows a guy, and he'll find out who took Benedict's money within 72 hours. Instead, Terry gives Danny over to the police, and he's arrested for violating parole. Tess bumps into Terry as she's leaving, and she lets him know she knows what just happened. She catches up with Danny before the police take him away and promises to wait for him to come out of jail, just as he planned. Everyone in the crew, minus Ocean, about $15 million richer, watches the dancing fountain show in front of the Bellagio before leaving one by one. We cut to 3 to 6 months later. Danny is released from the same prison as earlier, only this time Rusty is waiting for him with Tess in the car. Danny mocks Rusty's old car when Rusty points out that Benedict's thugs are currently watching them. Danny joins Tess in the back of the car, and Rusty drives them off, still unconcerned about Benedict's thugs following them down the road. And you know my penchant for fun credits. We get most of the characters in alphabetical order, and then at the very end we get Introducing Julia Roberts
as Tess, yes. And apparently George Clooney sent her the script with a $20 bill attached to it. saying, I heard you're getting 20 a movie now.
Yeah.
So that was a little joke as well. So this is a remake of a 1960 movie called Ocean's 11, except that I can't remember how. Oh, now I remember how it goes. In the original, 11 was the number, where in this version, it's the word 11 used in the title.
Right.
But the original version was also set in Las Vegas and also involved folks trying to rob multiple casinos. It was actually 5 casinos, and it was done by a group of Army veterans. And as opposed to Saul faking a heart attack, in this version, the one of the 11, played by Richard Conte, actually suffers a heart attack, which leads to something I'm going to get back to in a moment. And when Danny claims that he, in the remake, that he knows someone who would know about any job pulled off like that, that's referring to a character from the original who does know about any job that we would be pulled off like that, which is why it's frustrating for him at first, because everyone that he goes to in the original doesn't know about it, because these are not professional thieves that are doing it. It isn't until he learns about someone being in town that wasn't necessarily supposed to be in town that he figures out what happened. And the guy in the original is played by Cesar Romero. And although I've mentioned a couple of fairly well-known actors in the movie, the real well-known folks in the original version of Ocean's 11 are the Rat Pack,
right,
which was Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Peter Lawford, the guy whose appearance alerts Romero's character about who might have pulled the job in the first place, and Joey Bishop, among others. And apparently Lawford was the guy who brought the idea to Sinatra in the first place. And Sinatra apparently joked in real life, why don't we just pull the robberies ourselves instead of doing the movie? And that, I think, is a key to why the movie, the original version, while certainly entertaining enough, I mean, certainly the heist jobs are pulled off pretty well, it doesn't really do much. You know, it's pretty obvious the folks involved didn't really care about anything more than a paycheck and just hanging around. And, you know, there's a scene where Dean Martin's character brings up a debate about the whole morality of the thing, and you don't really believe it, you know. And the original version was directed by Lewis Milestone, who had made some great movies. The original version of All Quiet on the Western Front, which is still one of the best anti-war movies ever made. He also did the original sound version. I don't know if there was a silent version, but the original sound version, there couldn't have been a silent version anyway. The original version of Mice and Men, which, although I happen to like the 1992 version directed by Gary Sinise and starring him and John Malkovich, the 1939 version with Burgess Meredith and Lon Chaney Jr. Yeah. is still better. And he also did one of the strangest and most entertaining film noirs of the 40s, The Strange Love of Martha Ivers, which is a wicked little film that if it ever pops up on TCM or you think about running it somewhere off of a streaming network, check it out. You'll be glad you did. So those are all legitimate highlights in his career. Ocean's 11, he was a hired hand on. It was not as unpleasant an experience maybe as was his very last movie, the 1962 version of Mutiny on the Bounty, but it was not one that he looked back on fondly. And, you know, he doesn't really display any directorial touches in this. So Ocean's 11, the original, well, you might like the motive a little more for why they pulled the robbery. It just kind of lays there. Whereas the remake of Ocean's 11, I feel, is pure fun from beginning to end.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I got to agree. I'm not even sure I finished watching the original version. It kind of bored me. And I was like, you know, it was starting to feel a little bit like homework. And it's not like I tried rewatching it for this. But just thinking back to my original, you know, you're taking one for the team there. So, it's like you said, it just felt like everybody was just kind of like hanging out and doing their thing and kind of having fun with it. But it doesn't necessarily come together as an especially good story. It doesn't, I mean, you've got that funny, fun little, you know, twist at the end. Okay, fine.
Yes,
you
know, I will admit.
But, you know, it was a little bit of work to watch. And I don't know. And the thing is that I wasn't sure if this was something which, you know, it was kind of a hot film at the time. And, you know, everybody watched it because they wanted to see the Rat Pack in action. And being of a later generation, I was just like, you know, what's the big deal? Or if it just wasn't especially that great. And I think it just wasn't especially that great, frankly, compared to this version, which, you know, it's funny. I don't think there's any one scene that really, really stands out for me as, you know, outstanding cinema or anything like that. But the thing is, the story just carries you along so nicely from one piece to the next, to the next, to the next. And that before you know it, like, you know, 2 hours have gone by and the movie's over and you're like, wow, that was cool.
Right. Now, there is one scene I do think that does, you know, if not outstanding cinema, at least very good cinema, which is a nod to a scene in the original, which I'll get to a little later. But first, I will admit the one thing about the original that I did like, you know, a lot of movies where that ended a certain way during that time because of the code. You could tell ended that way because of the code, and you just either had to say, oh, come on, or shrug your shoulders and moved on. In the original, of course, they hide the money from the heist in Richard Conte's coffin,
right?
And the widow decides to have him cremated, and I thought that was a nice little clever touch, but not as clever as what's done in this movie. Now, part of the reason why this is so entertaining is, again, like the remake of the Thomas Crown Affair, and like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which we discussed in the previous episode, all of these movies and Oceans are trying to be elegant in how they're done. And that leads me to an anecdote concerning the guy who sang the cover version of the theme song for the remake of the Thomas Crown Affair, Sting. On his second solo album, Nothing Like the Sun, he did a song called Englishman in New York, which, although it's partially about him, it's mostly about Quentin Crisp, playwright, and one of the first major openly gay man in Britain in the 60s, back when that was still a crime. And in the liner notes to the album, Sting mentions talking to Chris when he's in New York and asking him what he wants to do. And he says, I want to pull off a crime. And Sting, of course, immediately thinks murder. So he's a little nervous about that and says, what kind of crime? And Chris said, oh, something elegant with a dash of style to it. Crime is rarely elegant these days. I'm paraphrasing there. And that's what all three of these movies, and even to a certain extent the remake of The Man Who Knew Too Much, are going for, is sort of an elegance of style. And the danger, or not the danger, the trap for something like that that you have to avoid is that even though it takes a lot of effort to make something that elegant and stylish, you have to make sure that effort doesn't show up on the screen, that it has to appear effortless.
Right.
And it certainly does appear effortless in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. It appears effortless in the remake of The Thomas Crown Affair. And it definitely appears effortless in the remake of Ocean's 11. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things that had to go right that did. There is a lot of work that had to be done on this. There were a lot of casting things that didn't quite work out. You know, the Coen brothers were originally lined up to play the Malloy brothers, for example, but they backed out. And then Owen and Luke Wilson were also apparently thought of to play the Malloys as well, but they also backed out. Bill Murray was going to play a lounge singer, but he was too busy with the Royal Tenenbaums and all things like that. But when you put this all together, you know, Albert Einstein once said that genius is 5% inspiration and 95% perspiration. No perspiration shows up for any of these movies, particularly with the remake of Ocean's 11.
I thought that was Thomas Edison. All right. But you're right. It has an effortless look, and that's the thing that makes it especially good. You know, there's a lot of fun little character touches. I notice, like, every time Brad Pitt's on camera, he's eating something.
Yes.
And except for the very end where he's like, well, he has something in his hand. He takes a bite and he gives him like a big burp and then he like tosses it away. But for the most part, yeah, you've got that going on. You've got just like I said, a lot of funky little touches. And it is clear that the Bellagio actually cooperated in this particular case to
yes.
let them do some of the stuff that they were going to do.
Yes, Jerry Weintraub, who was the producer of the movie, was apparently friends with the guys who ran the Bellagio, so he was able to arrange that. And by the way, Brad Pitt eating all the time, that was because he didn't have a chance to eat and he figured that Rusty wouldn't, so he was eating it. And it's having seen this movie enough times, normally I don't pay attention to gaffes, but I did notice after several viewings that in his scene with Matt Damon, right before Julia Roberts first appears, mm-hmm. you know, in two different shots, you notice that he's eating two different kinds of food and he has it in different ways. But again, in a different hand in shots that don't match. But again, didn't bother me when I first watched it because I was just so taken with everything.
Yeah, not a big deal. And like, you know, you mentioned, you know, about the different people who might have been cast in this film. And I did see some of those names and I was like, yeah, you know what? That's okay. I'm okay uh-huh. with that person not being in this film. And I'm thinking especially like Bill Murray, because Bill Murray, like, he did that lounge singer thing as a Saturday Night Live bit. You might remember. I know I'm a little bit older than
you. When we talked about Lost in Translation.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So, and so, he can carry it off, but the fact is he did that as a very smarmy kind of character, and that's something that he could easily slide into here. And, you know, when he was doing that, he was doing like a parody of like a Wayne Newton or that kind of thing. And I think I saw Wayne Newton in the crowd during the fight at one point. So there were a few like fun little cameos in there as well. But anyway, unless he could dial it back into that kind of thing where he's being like more Wayne Newton and less Nick, whatever the last name is for the bit, okay, because it would change every time, Nick the Lounge Singer, then yeah, he might have been able to pull it off. But the fact is, you know, a lot of the comedy that this film pulls out is very natural. It's not that people are necessarily saying funny things, it's that they're saying things funny, if you can understand the distinction I'm pulling here.
Yes.
So
yes. And one of those ways, admittedly, was the focus of some criticism, and that is Don Cheadle's attempt at a Cockney accent. And my feeling about that is, you know, if this was a serious role, then yeah, I would object to it. But my feeling about it is the same as my feeling about those who complain about Dick Van Dyke's attempt at a Cockney accent in Mary Poppins, which is...
disastrous?
No, it's supposed to be fun. It is. And so, yeah, Terrence in Soderbergh's previous movie, but a movie done earlier, The Limey, you know, obviously Terrence Stamp is more well-equipped to deliver a convincing Cockney accent than either Cheadle or Van Dyke was. But because it's supposed to be fun, you know, I didn't have a problem with it because I thought it was fun.
Plus, yeah, it was. I think the only time it didn't really work was there was one scene where he's like starting to launch into the rhyming slang and he has to stop and explain it.
I liked that when he says, you know, that we're all in Barney and everyone's looking at him like, what are you talking about? And he says, Barney Rubble, trouble.
Yeah, but that was the thing. You know, he had to stop. He had to explain. It was okay. You know, it felt like it slowed things down for a little bit and unnecessarily. You know, if you're in a situation where... yeah, I mean, but if you're in a situation where time is of the essence and this was one of these things where everything had to be very well timed, you're not going to say stuff that you're going to have to stop and explain to people, especially when he's doing it like, of course this is what it means. We didn't know that.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that's part of the comedy of the movie, the way that genre conventions are sort of turned around on their head, which is part of what Soderbergh and screenwriter Ted Griffin were bringing to the movie to try and make it look that this is not just another cookie-cutter big studio movie. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got like the scene where Ruben's first scene with Danny and Rusty, when right before they tell him that the casinos they're robbing are Terry Benedict's casinos.
Yeah.
And he has a line there where he says, look, we all go way back, and I owe you from the thing with the guy in the place, and I'll never forget it.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of a twist there. And then also when Rusty is coaching Linus on how to appear when he's supposed to be the guy from the gaming commission.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he says, you know, don't use seven words when three would do, you know, giving them all this advice. And then he finally says, and most importantly, under no circumstances should you ever... And then Livingston interrupts them by saying, Rusty, can he come here a sec? And Rusty says, sure.
And we never find out what that would be.
We never find out what that's saying. And then, of course, when Danny first gives Rusty the plan, and Rusty is saying things like, you know, that's at least Ivan Bosky, and on top of that, the best Ella Fitzgerald that I've ever seen pulled. You know, things like that that would normally be part of something that's explained in detail, but in here it's all shorthand. So I didn't really mind. All of this is a roundabout way of saying I felt like the Cockney explanation of the Cockney slang was in that spirit. And then also in that spirit is the fact that while the amazing Yen, and by the way, the guy who plays him is a real-life acrobat. Mm-hmm. That's why he was cast. The fact that he only speaks Mandarin, but Rusty and maybe one of the other characters understands him perfectly, and he understands perfectly the English that's said to him. And the only English line in English that he has is, "What the fuck is that?"
There you go.
You know, after the failed heist. And then, oh yeah, when Danny is trying to set off the explosives and it doesn't work and they have to change the batteries.
Yeah, that was a nice bit.
Yeah, so all that I think is keeping with the comic spirit of the movie. And then another thing that I think is keeping, that helps with that whole style bit, is the fact that this was the second movie, I believe, that Soderbergh served as his own cinematographer. The first one, although he did it under the pseudonym of Peter Andrews, the first one was Traffic, which, of course, is a much darker movie. You know, whereas Traffic, you had scenes of people getting tortured and people getting killed. Here, Soderbergh wanted to make sure that nobody actually gets hurt in the movie. And even in the scene where there's gunfire, of course, that is all part of the con. But the fact that he served as the cinematographer of the movie means that, according to him, anyway, he was better able to direct the actors. And although, as he said, you know, he wasn't trying to be Gordon Willis, he does make the whole thing move very well. And there is one bit of, there's one cinematic flourish that does show up in the movie that is a callback to something that was done in the original. After the heist is successfully pulled off and they all walk out, without Danny, of course, to the fountain in front of the Bellagio, that's a nod to the end of the original, where all the 10 remaining members of Ocean's 11 walk out of the funeral home after realizing that they've lost all of the loot. Mm-hmm. And it's shot, unlike the original, which was shot during the day, this is shot at night. And or at least it may have been shot, it may have been a day for night thing. And we hear Debussy's Clair de Lune playing over the soundtrack, which is a nice bit of music. So all of that, I think, was a nice cinematic touch there.
Yeah, especially in as much as when we first go into that scene, it's a view of the men from the front, and you're just panning across the whole line of guys as they are looking at something, we don't know what. And then finally we get the reverse angle, we see the entire bunch of them. I think there's actually a second shot that looks down the line, and then finally there's a view from behind them, and you can see that they're watching the fountain as they're listening to the music, and then they finally peel off one by one.
Right. And another thing that Soderbergh wanted to do to make things a little different And unfortunately, the setup for two sequels that I don't think were as good as the original is having Terry Benedict's guys there when Danny is getting out of prison and following him and Rusty and Tess along there. And so even though he was trying to make just an entertainment, you know, he did try and put things in there, you know, like even the parole board hearing, although Ted Griffin, when he wrote that, he said that in the commentary on the DVD I own, he said that he didn't realize at first when he was writing that, that basically that whole scene of the main character talking to people we don't hear, one of whom, by the way, is played by Viola Davis, that he didn't realize that Soderbergh had used that with Julia Roberts in Aaron Brockovich at the beginning of that movie. And that had he known that, he might have decided to open the movie a little differently than he did. But, you know, that whole parole board scene and the fact that Danny calls his parole officer, even though you know he's lying and he's going to go to Vegas, you know, the fact that he includes that scene at all means that this is somewhat different from your standard studio heist movie would be.
Yeah, sure enough. And in fact, I mean, he's already been in the casino. He's already, you know, hooked up with Frank. He's already violated parole. You know, never mind the fact, well, I don't know if he's allowed to be in the casino, but the fact that he hooked up with Frank, who is a known criminal also, okay, you're in trouble now. And then, yes, the very next thing we see him, yes, I'm being good, I haven't had a drink and blah, 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 blah. And then the next thing we see, he's in Hollywood. So he's left New Jersey. He has already violated parole. There you go. So long.
Yes. And of course, just because Clooney is the star of the movie, and I guess he was one of the people behind trying to get this remake made in the first place, that doesn't mean that Soderbergh and company are unwilling to have a little fun at his expense. When we first see him at the poker game, he's asking the TV actors if it's hard to break in from TV to movies. And of course, he had to go through that himself. Right. And by the way, all the actors who Rusty and Danny are playing poker with, those are real TV actors. Yes, but I'm going to identify them now.
Go for it.
The guy who talks the most to Rusty, Topher Grace, of course, was known for That 70s Show, although he's also in Traffic.
Yes.
And then you've got Joshua Jackson, who at the time was best known for Dawson's Creek. Mm-hmm. Barry Watson, who was known for Seventh Heaven. Shane West, who... although his show was not as popular, unfortunately, as those other three shows, was on Once and Again. And the only woman in the group there was Holly Marie Combs, who was known for both Picket Fences and the original version of Charmed. Mm-hmm. So... that's a nice little bit of trivia. And as far as the actors and the regular cast go, I don't think there's much to say about them in detail, except that, you know, Carl Reiner does a very good German accent.
Yes.
And it's convincing, unlike... Cheadles, but again, I don't care about that. And all of them, you know, they may be just playing to their personas or whatever, but unlike the Rat Pack, it seems like they're actually invested in this as well. So the scene that Clooney has with Julia Roberts, even though it is a pretty standard scene when they're in the restaurant and they get to fighting, the two of them actually have somewhat of a rapport with each other.
Yeah.
So you care about what happens to them. And although I can understand those who feel that the arguing between Casey Affleck and Scott Kahn might be a little goes a long way for them, I do think that they are actually pretty funny together.
Yeah, they work very well together. And you know, from the very beginning, you get the little bit of bickering when he's going to race the giant truck against the little motorized thing, and they have a little drag race, and the big truck just finally jumps out of the lane and smushes the truck. So you can see that that these guys have kind of built into a relationship with one another, and just that's the nature of how these guys talk to one another, is just through the bickering. And more often than not, every time we see them, they're doing some version of that. And then finally, when it comes time to be in part of the heist, that actually becomes part of what they have to do, as they are bringing the money cart into the vault, and the two of them are again like, "You forgot the, I can't believe you forgot the key, da 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 da." So they can fall right into it in order to get that cart into the vault.
Right. And what was I gonna say? Oh, and you know, the fact that that throughout the movie they're speaking in shorthand. Apparently Griffin was inspired in that aspect by The Magnificent Seven and also The Great Escape, where characters are talking about things that they know and no one else does. So that's why they can speak in the shorthand like that. And another reason why this movie might seem so relaxed on screen is because of how many people had worked with Soderbergh before. Of course, we mentioned Clooney worked with him on Out of Sight. Topher Grace and Don Cheadle were both in Traffic, and Cheadle was also in Out of Sight. Roberts was in Aaron Brockovich, and Eddie Jemison, who is one of the least known members of the cast, he was in one of Soderbergh's more experimental movies, Schizopolis. One last word about Soderbergh. You know, when we talked about Out of Sight, we mentioned that he felt that his career was at a standstill. With Ocean's 11, he was coming from a position of strength. You know, the two previous movies that he'd done, Aaron Brockovich and Gladiator, they both made hundreds of millions of dollars, and they were popular with critics and also at the Oscars. Roberts won Best Actress for Aaron Brockovich, and Soderbergh won Best Director for Traffic, which also won Best Adapted Screenplay. So the fact that he was taking on a remake might have seemed like a step back, but instead he turned it into a lot of fun. This was not the last remake he did. He did a remake or a second version of Stellaris, which hardly anyone saw but me, and people did not like too much, though I happen to think it's very good and comparable with the original version. And but this, you know, this was the last movie of what I would say is the five movie hot streak with Out of Sight. I mean, I like, as I mentioned when we talked about Out of Sight, I like the movies he did before well, but Out of Sight, The Limey, Aaron Brockovich, Traffic, Ocean's 11 were all critical hits, and they were all very good movies.
Yeah, to be sure. Let me ask you a question about him, though. Is on the films, and it's a lot of them, where he acted as his own cinematographer, he's not using his own name. Is there a reason for that other than just to put a separate name on the screen? Or is there like some sort of guild rule there?
Well, I think it's a little bit of one, a little bit of column A, and a little bit of column B, as you would say. I don't think he wants to join the cinematographers union, but he also doesn't want to come off as too egotistical. You know, he's also edited movies under the name Marianne Bernard, although not this one. This one was edited by Stephen Mirion, who has who's edited movies for Alejandro González Iñárritu, particularly Babel and Birdman.
Okay, fair enough.
So do you have anything else you want to bring up before I answer the trivia question?
No, go ahead. I'm anxious to do this one. I think I know it. I think I know it for sure.
Okay, so who were the members of the original cast of Ocean's 11 who show up in the remake? That would be Angie Dickinson, who plays Danny Ocean's wife, and Henry Silva, who played one of the 11. They both appear at the fight. They're among the folks who cameo as themselves at the fight, along with, as you mentioned, Wayne Newton. And also, I believe, though I'm not 100% sure, Jerry Weintraub is also in the fight audience. And he was the producer.
No, he is in the film. He was a gambler. He was one of the gamblers.
Oh, yeah.
But okay. also in the crowd was Steve and Edie. Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet.
Yes.
And Siegfried and Roy.
Okay. Who represent the kind of Vegas showbiz ethos that the Rat Pack were associated with. So
I knew that one. Good for me.
Yes. So this is the part where we tell you that both Ocean's 11 and Thomas Crown Affair are available on DVD with the commentaries that I mentioned. There's another commentary on the Ocean's 11 DVD with the cast, though apparently they don't have much insightful stuff to say. I guess it's more if you like to hear them clowning around. I haven't watched it with their commentary yet. But if you prefer not to watch it on a hard copy, as far as the Thomas Crown Affair goes, you can stream it if you subscribe to Max, either by itself or through Amazon, or if you subscribe to, DirecTV, or you could rent or buy it through Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, and most other streaming services. As for Ocean's 11, you can stream it if you subscribe to TNT Online or TBS Online or to True TV, or you could rent or buy it through Amazon, Apple Play, Google Play, and most other streaming services.
To be sure. And what's happening next time around?
Well, next we've got the first of another two-part series where we look at updated fairy tales.
Okay.
And the first ones are from 1941, Ball of Fire, directed by Howard Hawks, and from 1986, Mona Lisa, directed and co-written by Neil Jordan. Both of those movies are also available on DVD. Mona Lisa is available on Criterion DVD, but if you would rather stream them, then you can stream Ball of Fire for free on Yahoo, as well as Canopy or Plex if you subscribe to either of those, or on Pluto TV if you're willing to put up with the ads. If not, you can rent or buy Ball of Fire exclusively on Amazon, Apple TV, or DirecTV. And as for Mona Lisa, you can only stream it if you subscribe to the Criterion channel, Max, or if you've subscribed to Max through Amazon. And you can find us on the web through our website, wordsandmovies.com, where you can leave a comment on any of our posts, or you can email us with a question or comment at our email address, wordsandmoviespod@gmail.com. Or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/wordsandmovies. And I am also on Facebook under my name, Sean Gallagher. And how about you, Claude?
Yes, I'm on that Book of Face under my name, Claude Call. Or you can check out my other podcast, How Good It Is. It's a pop music podcast, the story behind the song, at howgooditis.com.
So thanks for listening, everyone, and we will see you next time.
Thank you very much. And Alex, please take us away.
This is your announcer, Alexander Blackman, with the closing credits. This show was produced by Sean Gallagher and Claude Call, with editing and post-production by Claude, with some help from Ophonic. Audio clips are used under fair use rules for commentary and educational framing. Everything else is copyrighted by Claude Call and Sean Gallagher. The theme music you're bopping along to right now is by Solar Flare and is used under a Creative Commons license. Podcast hosting is provided by Spotify for podcasters. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.